Silence, then. I won't bleeding touch her. I can't help that her sister's gagging for it. I nearly choke, and Livy grips me. I had my reasons, she whispers. I will do what I must to keep this empire, Marcus growls, and for the first time I see something. A pale shadow, like a face glimpsed in a mirror underwater. A second later, it's gone, and I shake myself. A trick of the light, perhaps. If that means breaking a few fingers to keep your precious Bloodshrike in line, so be it. I wanted to break her arm. 10 hells, I breathe to Livia. He's barking. He's gone mad. He thinks what he's seeing is real. Livia shakes her head. Maybe it is. It doesn't matter. He cannot remain on the throne. At best, he's taking orders from a ghost. At worst, he's hallucinating. We have to support him, I say. The augurs named him emperor. If he's deposed or killed, we risk civil war, or the commandant swooping in and naming herself empress. Do we? Livy takes my hand with her good one and places it on her stomach. She doesn't speak. She doesn't have to.
Oh, you, that's why you and he... Oh.
Blackcliff prepared me for many things. It did not prepare me for my sister's pregnancy by the man who slit the throats of our parents and sister.
This is our answer, Shrike. His heir, I whisper. A regency.
Bleeding skies. If Marcus disappears after the child is born, Livia and Jenza Quilla would run the empire until the child came of age. We could train the boy up to be a true and just statesman. The illustrian gens would accept it because the heir would be from a high-born house. The plebeians would accept it because he is Marcus's son and thus represents them too. But how do you know it's a boy? She turns her eyes, my eyes, our mother's eyes, to me, and I have never seen anyone look so sure of anything in my life.
It's a boy, Bloodshrike, she says. You must trust me. He already quickens. By the grain moon, if all is well, he will be here.
I shiver. The grain moon again.
When the commandant finds out, she'll come after you. I have to kill her.
Livia takes the words from my mouth.
Before she finds out.
When I ask Livia if Marcus knows of the pregnancy, she shakes her head.
I confirmed it only today, and I wanted to tell you first.
Tell him, Livy. I forget her title.
He wants an heir. Perhaps he won't.
I gesture to her hand.
But no one else. Hide it as best you can.
She puts a finger to my lips. Marcus's muttering has stopped.
Go, Shrike, Livy breathes. Mother, father, Hannah.
Suddenly I cannot breathe. He won't take Livy too. I'll die before I let it happen.
I'll fight him.
My sister digs her fingers into my shoulder. The pain focuses me.
You'll fight him.
She shoves me toward her room.
He'll die because he's no match for your anger. And in the frenzy to replace him, our enemies will have us both killed because we would have made it easy for them to do so. We must live. For him.
She touches her stomach.
For father and mother and Hannah. For the Empire.
Go!
She shoves me out the door, just as light floods the passageway. I race through her room, past Farris and Raelius, flipping over the balcony to the rope tied below, cursing myself as Marcus shouts, as he lands the first blow, as the crack of another of my sister's bones echoes in my ears.
Part 2. Inferno. Chapter 11. Liar. 4 weeks later. Darren and I jostle through the sea of scholar refugees on the rutted dirt road into Odessa. two more tired bodies and dirty faces amid the hundreds seeking sanctuary in Marin's shining capital city. Silence hangs like a fog over the refugees as they plod onward. Most of these scholars were turned away from the other mariner cities. All have seen homes lost, family and friends tortured or murdered, raped or imprisoned. The marshals wield their weapons of war with merciless efficiency. They want to break the scholars. And if I don't stop the Nightbringer, if I don't find this beekeeper in Edessa, they will. Shaver's prophecy haunts me. Darren and I discuss it obsessively, trying to make sense of each line. Bits of it, the sparrows, the butcher, dredge up old memories, scraps of thoughts that I cannot quite grasp hold of. We'll figure it out, Darren glances over, reading the furrow in my brow. We have bigger problems. Our shadow. The man appeared 3 days ago, trailing us as we left a small village, or at least that is when we first noticed him. Since then, he's remained far enough away that we cannot get a good look at him, but close enough that my blade feels fused to my palm. Every time I don my invisibility in the hopes of getting closer to him, he disappears. Still there, Darren chances a look behind us, lurking like a bleeding wraith. The circles beneath my brother's eyes make his irises look almost black. His cheekbones jut out as they did when I first rescued him from Koff. Since our shadow appeared, Darren has slept little. But even before that, nightmares of Koff and the Warden plagued him. Sometimes I wish the Warden back to life, just so I could kill him myself. Strange how monsters can reach from beyond the grave, as potent in death as they were in life. We'll lose him at the city gates, I try to sound convincing, and lie low when we get in. Find a cheap inn to stay at where no one will look at us twice. And then, I add, we can ask around for the beekeeper. Under the guise of adjusting my hood, I glance back quickly at our shadow. He's close now, and beneath the scarf that hides his face, his red sickle mouth curves into a smile. A weapon flashes in his hand. I spin back around. We wind down from the foothills, and Edessa's gold-flecked wall comes into view. A marvel of white granite that glows orange under the fading, blood-streaked sky. Along the eastern wall, a mass of grey tents blooms out for nearly a mile. The scholar refugee camp. In the bay to the north, sea ice floats in fat chunks, its briny smell slicing through the dirt and grime of the road. Clouds sit low on the horizon, and an estival wind blows in from the south, scattering them. As they part, a near-collective gasp ripples through the travelers, for in the center of Edessa, a spire of stone and glass soars into the sky, pinioning the heavens. It twists like the horn of some mythical creature, impossibly balanced and glowing white. I have only ever heard it described, but the descriptions do it no justice. The Great Library of Edessa. An unwelcome memory surfaces. Red hair, brown eyes, and a mouth that lied, lied, lied. Keenan, the Nightbringer, telling me that he too wanted to see the Great Library.
She tasted sweet, boy, like dew and a clear dawn.
My skin crawls thinking of the filth he spat in the waiting place. Look, I nod to the throngs gathered outside the city gates, pushing to enter before they close at nightfall. We can lose him there, especially if I disappear. When we are closer to the city, I drop in front of Darren, as if adjusting a bootlace. Then I pull on my invisibility. I'm right next to you, I whisper when I stand. And Darren nods, weaving quickly now through the crowd, using his sharp elbows to muscle forward. The closer we get to the gate, the slower it goes. Finally, as the sun dips into the west, we stand before the massive wooden entrance carved with whales and eels, octopuses and mermaids. Beyond, a cobbled street curves up and disappears into a warren of brightly painted buildings, lamps winking in their windows. I think of my mother, who came to Edessa when she was only a few years older than me. Did it look the same? Did she share the awe I feel now?
Your guarantor, sir.
One of the dozens of mariner guards fixes his attention on Darren, and despite the seething crowds, he is coolly polite. Darren shakes his head in confusion.
My guarantor? Who are you staying with in the city? What family or guild?
We're staying at an inn, Darren says.
We can pay. Gold can be stolen. I require names. The inn where you plan to procure rooms and your guarantor. Who can vouch for your quality? Once you provide names, you will wait in a holding area while your information is verified. After which, you may enter Edessa.
Darren looks uncertain. We do not know anyone in Edessa. Since leaving Elias, we have tried several times to get in touch with Araj, the Skirite leader, who escaped Koff with us, but have heard nothing back from him. Darren nods at the soldier's explanation, as if we have any idea what we will do instead.
And if I don't have a guarantor, you'll find the entrance to the Scholar refugee camp east of here.
The soldier, who until now had kept his attention on the pressing crowd behind us, finally looks at Darren. The man's eyes narrow.
Say.
Time to go, I hiss to my brother, and he mumbles something to the soldier before quickly shoving back into the crowd.
He can't have known my face, Darren says. I've never met him before.
Maybe all scholars look alike to him, I say, but the explanation rings hollow to me. More than once, we turn to see if the soldier follows. I slow down only when I spot him at the gate, speaking with another group of scholars. Our shadow also appears to have lost us, and we head east, making our way to one of a dozen long lines that lead into the refugee camp. Nan told me stories of what Mother did when she led the Northern Resistance here in Edessa, more than 25 years ago. The Mariner King, Ermond, worked with her to protect the scholars, to give them work and homes and a permanent place in Mariner society. Things have clearly gone to pot since then. Even from outside the boundaries of the camp, its gloom is pervasive. Bands of children wander through the tents ahead, most far too young to be left unaccompanied. A few dogs slink through the muddy roadways, occasionally sniffing at the open sewers. Why is it always us? All of these people, so many children, hunted and abused and tormented, families stolen, lives shattered. They come all this way to be rejected yet again, sent outside the city walls to sleep in flimsy tents, to fight over paltry scraps of food, to starve and freeze and suffer more. And we are expected to be thankful, to be happy. So many are, I know it, happy to be safe, to be alive. But it's not enough, not to me. As we get closer to the entrance, the camp comes into clearer view. White parchment flutters from the cloth walls. I squint at it, but it's not until we're nearing the front of the line that I finally make out what's on it. My own face. Darren's, staring out sullenly beneath damning words. By personal decree of King Armand of Marin, wanted, Lyra and Darren of Sarah, for incitement of rebellion, agitation, and conspiring against the crown. Reward, 10,000 marks. It looks like the posters from the Commandant's office at Blackcliff, like the one from Ner, when the Blood Shrike was hunting Elias and me and offering a massive reward.
What in the skies?
I whisper, did we do to King Ermond to offend him so? Could the marshals be behind it?
They don't bleeding know we're here.
They have spies just like everyone else, I say. Look back, like you see someone you recognize, and then walk. A commotion at the back of the line ripples toward us as a squad of mariner troops marches toward the camp from Edessa. Darin hunches down, taking refuge deeper in his hood. Shouts ring out ahead of us, and light flares sharply, followed quickly by a plume of black smoke. Fire. The shouts quickly turn to cries of rage and fear. My mind seizes. My thoughts go to Sarah, to the night the soldiers took Darin. The pounding at our door and the silver of the mask's face. Nan's and Pop's blood on the floor, and Darin screaming at me. Liar! Run! Voices around me rise in terror. Scholars in the camp flee. Groups of children cluster, making themselves small, hoping they are not noticed. Blue and gold-clad mariner soldiers weave through the tents, tearing them apart as they search for something. No. Someone. The scholars around us scatter, running every which way, driven by a fear that's been hammered into our bones. Always us. Our dignity shredded, our families annihilated, our children torn from their parents. Our blood soaking the dirt. What sin was so great that scholars must pay with every generation, with the only thing we have left? Our lives. Darin, calm just a moment ago, is motionless beside me, looking as terror-stricken as I feel. I grab his hand. I cannot fall apart now, not when he needs me to hold it together. Let's go. I pull him away, but there are soldiers herding those in the lines back toward the camp. Close by, I spy a dark space between two refugee tents. Quick, Darin! A voice cries out behind us. They're not here! A scholar woman, who is naught but skin and bones, tries to shake off a mariner soldier. I've told you! We know you're sheltering them! The mariner, who speaks, is taller than me by a few inches, her scaled silver armor tight against the powerful muscles of her shoulders. Her chiseled brown face lacks the cruelty of a mask, but she is nearly as intimidating. She tears a poster off the side of one of the tents, where it's been pinned. Turn over Lyra and Darin of Sarah, and we will leave you be. Otherwise, we will raise this camp and scatter its refugees to the four winds. We are generous, true. That does not make us fools. Beyond the soldier, dozens of scholar children are being herded toward a makeshift holding pen. A cloud of embers explodes into the sky as, behind them, two more tents go up in flames. I shudder at the way the fire growls and vaunts, as if it is celebrating the screams rising from my people. It's the prophecy, Darin whispers. Do you remember? The sparrows will drown. And none will know it. The scholars must be the sparrows, Lyra. The mariners have always been called the sea people. They are the flood. We cannot let it happen, I make myself say the words. They're suffering because of us. This is the only home they have, and we're taking it away from them. Darin immediately understands my intent. He shakes his head, taking a step back, movements jerky and panicked. No. He says. We can't. How are we supposed to find the beekeeper if we're in prison? Or dead? How are we supposed to? His voice chokes off, and he shakes his head again and again. I know they will lock us up. I grab him, shake him. I need to break through his terror. I need him to believe me. But I swear to the skies that I will get us out. We cannot let the camp burn, Darin. It's wrong. The mariners want us. And we're right here. A scream erupts from behind us. A scholar man claws at a mariner guard, howling as she removes a child from his grasp. Don't hurt her, he begs. Please, please. Darin watches, shuddering. You're right, He fights to get the words out, and I am relieved and proud and broken-hearted because I feel sick at the thought of watching my brother dragged back to a prison. I'll have no one else die for me, especially not you. I'll turn myself in. You'll be safe. Not a chance, I say. Never again. Where you go, I go. I drop my invisibility, and vertigo nearly levels me. My sight darkens to a dank room with a light-haired woman within. I cannot see her face. Who is she? When my vision clears, only a few seconds have passed. I shake the strange images away and leave the shelter of the tents. The mariner soldier's instinct is excellent, for though we are a good 30 feet from her, the moment we step into the light, her head swivels toward us. The plume and angled eye holes of her helmet make her look like an angry hawk, but her hand is light on her sim as she watches our approach.
Laya and Darin of Sera.
She doesn't sound surprised, and I know then that she expected to find us here, that she knew we had arrived in Edessa.
You are under arrest for conspiracy to commit crimes against the kingdom of Marin. You will come with me.
Chapter 12. Elias. Though the sun hasn't yet set, the tribal encampment is quiet when I approach. The cook fires are doused, the horses sheltered beneath a canvas tarp. The red and yellow painted wagons are sealed tight against the driving late spring rain. One lamplight flickers within. I move slowly, though not out of wariness. My Arthur tugs at me, and it requires all my strength to ignore that summons. A few hundred yards west of the caravan, the Duskan Sea breaks against the rocky shore, its roar nearly drowning out the mournful cries of white-headed gulls above. But my mask's instincts are as sharp as ever, and I sense the approach of the Kahani of Tribe Nasur long before she appears, along with the 6 Nasur tribesmen guarding her.
Elias Vittorius.
The Kahani's silver dreadlocks hang to her waist, and I can clearly make out the elaborate storyteller's tattoos on her dark brown skin.
You are late.
I am sorry, Kahani. I don't bother giving her an excuse. Kahanis are as skilled at trapping lies as they are at telling stories. I beg your forgiveness.
Bah!
She sniffs.
You begged to meet with me, too. I do not know why I consented. Marshals took my brother's son a week ago, after they raided our grain stores. My respect for Mimi Rila is all that keeps me from gutting you like a pig, boy.
I'd like to see you try. Have you heard from Mimi?
She is well hidden and recovering from the horrors your ilk inflicted upon her. If you think I will tell you where she is, you are a bigger fool than I suspected. Come.
She jerks her head toward the caravan, and I follow. I understand her rage. The marshal's war on the tribes is evident in every burned-out wagon littering the countryside, every ululating wail rising from tribal villages as families mourn those taken. The Kahani moves quickly, and as I trail her, my Arthur's pull grows stronger, a physical wrench that makes me want to sprint back to the waiting place, 3 leagues distant. A sense of wrongness steals over me, as if I've forgotten something important, but I can't tell if it is my own instinct prickling, or if my Arthur is manipulating my mind. More than once in the past few weeks, I felt someone, or something, flitting at the edges of the waiting place, entering and then leaving, as if trying to gauge a reaction. Every time I've felt it, I've windwalked to the border, and every time I've found nothing. The rain has, at least, silenced the djinn. Those fiery bastards hate it. But the ghosts are troubled, forced to remain in the waiting place longer than they should, because I cannot pass them through fast enough. Shaver's warning haunts me.
If you do not pass the ghosts through, it will mean your failure as soul catcher and the end of the human world as you understand it.
Martha pulls at me again, but I make myself ignore it. The Kahani and I weave our way through the wagons of the caravan until we reach one that sits apart from the rest, its black draping in sharp contrast to the elaborate decorations of the other wagons. It is the home of a fakir, the tribesperson who prepares bodies for burial. I wipe the rain from my face as the Kahani knocks on the wooden back door. "With respect," I say, "I need to speak to you.
I keep the stories of the living. The fakira keeps the stories of the dead."
The back door of the wagon opens almost immediately to reveal a girl of perhaps 16. At the sight of me, her eyes widen, and she pulls at her halo of red-brown curls. She chews on her lip, freckles stark against skin that is lighter than Mamie's but darker than mine. Deep blue tattoos wind up her arms, geometric patterns that make me think of skulls. Something about the uncertainty of her posture reminds me of Lyra, and a pang of longing flashes through me. I realize that I've frozen at the door, and the Kahani shoves me into the wagon, which is lit brightly by multicolored tribal lamps. A shelf along the back is filled with jars of fluid, and there is a faint smell of something astringent.
"This,"
the Kahani says from the door once I'm inside,
"is Abarit, our new fakira. She is learning."
The Kahani curls her lips slightly. No wonder the Kahani agreed to help me. She's simply foisting me onto a girl who will likely be no help at all.
"She will deal with you."
The door slams, leaving Abarit and me staring at each other for an awkward moment. "You're young," I blurt out as I sit. "Ah, Saif Fakir was older than the hills."
"Fear not, Bahai."
Abarit uses the honorific for brother, and her shaking voice reflects her anxiety. I immediately feel guilty for bringing up her age.
"I have been trained in the mysteries. You come from the forest, Elias Veturius. From the domain of the Bani el Ma'atha. Does she send you to aid us?"
Did she just say Ma'atha? How do you know that name, Ma'atha? Do you mean Shaiva?
"Ashtaga!"
Abarit squeaks the oath against the evil eye.
"We do not use her name, Bahai. The Bani el Ma'atha is holy, the chosen of death. The soul catcher, the guardian at the gates. The sacred mystery of her existence is known only to the fakirs and their apprentices. I would not have even spoken of it, only you came from the Jaga el Ma'atha."
"Place of Ma'atha. Shaiva, the Bani el Ma'atha." I suddenly find it hard to speak. "She's dead. I'm her replacement. She was training me when..." Abarit drops so fast I think her heart has failed.
"Banu al Ma'atha, forgive me."
I note the alteration of the title to reflect a male instead of a female, which is when I realize that she has not had some sort of fainting fit. She's kneeling.
"I did not know."
"No need for that." I pull her to her feet, embarrassed at her awe. "I'm struggling to pass the ghosts on," I say. "I need to use the magic at the heart of the waiting place, but I don't know how. The ghosts are building up. Every day there are more." Abarit blanches, and her knuckles pale as she clasps her hands together.
This cannot be, Banu al Ma'atha. You must pass them on. If you do not..."
"What happens?" I lean forward. "You spoke of mysteries. How did you learn them? Are they written down? Scrolls? Books?" The fakira taps her head.
"To write down the mysteries is to rob them of their power. Only the fakirs and fakiras learn them, for we are with the dead as they leave the world of the living. We wash them and commune with their spirits, so they move easily through the Jaga al-Ma'atha and to the other side. The soul catcher does not see them. She, you, are not meant to. Have you ever wondered why there are so few ghosts from the tribes?
Shaver's words. Do your mysteries say anything of the waiting place's magic?
No, Banu al-Ma'atha,
Abarit says.
Though...
Her voice drops and takes on the cadence of a long-memorized chant.
If thou seekest the truth in the trees, the forest will show thee its sly memory.
A memory? I frown. Shaver said nothing of this. The trees have seen much, no doubt, but the magic I have doesn't allow me to speak with them. Arborit shakes her head.
The mysteries are rarely literal. Forest could mean the trees, or it could be referring to something else entirely.
Metaphorical talking trees won't help me. What of the Bani al-Ma'atha, I ask. Did you ever meet her? Did she speak to you of the magic, or how she did her work?
I met her once, when Grandfather chose me as his apprentice. She gave me her benediction. I thought she sent you to help us.
Help you? I say sharply. With the marshals?
No, with...
She swallows back the words.
Do not concern yourself with such trifles, Banu al-Ma'atha. You must move the spirits, and to do that you must remove yourself from the world. Not waste your time helping strangers.
Tell me what's going on, I say. I can decide whether it concerns me or not. Arborit wrings her hands in indecision, but when I chuff expectantly, she speaks, her voice low.
Our fakirs and fakiras, she says. They're dying. A few were killed in martial attacks, but... Others,
she shakes her head.
My grandfather was found in a pond just a few feet deep. His lungs were filled with water, but he knew how to swim.
His heart might have failed.
He was strong as a bull, and not yet in his sixth decade. That's only part of it, Banu al-Ma'atha. I struggled to reach his spirit. You must understand, I have been training as a fakira since I could speak. I have never thought to commune with a spirit. This time, it felt as if something was blocking me. When I succeeded, Grandfather's ghost was deeply troubled. It would not speak to me. Something is wrong. I've not heard from the other fakirs. Everyone is so concerned with the marshals. But this is bigger than that, and I do not know what to do.
A sharp tug nearly pulls me to my feet. I sense impatience on the other end. Perhaps Ma'atha doesn't wish me to learn this information. Perhaps the magic wants me to remain ignorant. Get word out to your fakirs, I say. Their wagons should no longer be set apart from the rest of the caravan. By order of the Banu al-Ma'atha, who has expressed concern for their safety. And tell them to have their wagons repainted to match the others in the tribe. It will make it more difficult for your enemies to find you. I stop short. The pull at my core is strong enough that I feel like I might be sick. But I press on, because no one else is going to help Arborit or the fakirs. Ask the other fakirs if they are also finding it hard to commune with the spirits. I say, and find out if it's ever happened before.
The other fakirs don't listen to me.
You are new to your power. I need to go, but I cannot just leave her here, doubting herself, doubting her worth. But that doesn't mean you don't have it. Think of the way your Kahani wears her strength, like it's her own skin. That's who you must be, for your people. Ma'atha pulls me yet again, forcefully enough that, against my will, I stand. I have to return to the waiting place, I say. If you need me, come to the border of the forest. I'll know you're there, but do not try to enter. Moments later, I'm back out in the heavy rain. Lightning cracks over the waiting place, and I feel it hit within my domain. North, near the cabin, and closer, near the river. The awareness feels innate, like knowing I've gotten a cut or bite. As I windwalk home, I turn Arborit's words over in my head. Shaver never told me the fakirs were so deeply connected to her work. She never mentioned that they knew of her existence, let alone that they had built an entire mythology around her. All I knew about the fakirs was what most tribespeople know about them, that they handle the dead and that they are to be revered, albeit with more fear than one would revere a Zaldar or a Kahani. Maybe if I'd bleeding paid attention, I'd have noticed a connection. The tribes have always been deeply wary of the forest. Afia hates being near it, and Tribe Saif never came within 50 leagues of it when I was a child. As I near the waiting place, Ma'atha's pull, which by now should have weakened, gets stronger. Does he simply want me to come back? Does he want something more? The border is finally before me. And the moment I pass through, I am blasted by the howls of the ghosts. Their rage has peaked, transformed into something violent and deranged. How in the 10 hells did they get so riled up in the hour that I was gone? They press close to the border with a strange, single-minded focus. At first, I think that they are all pushing at something close to the wall. A dead animal, a dead body. But as I shove past them, shuddering at the chills rippling through my body, I realize that they aren't pressing at something near the wall. They are pushing at the wall itself. They are trying to get out.
Chapter 13. The Bloodshrike. The southern sky is stained black with smoke when the riverboat finally begins the approach to Navium. The rain that has drenched us for the past 2 weeks lingers on the horizon, taunting us, refusing to provide any relief. The Empire's greatest port city burns, and my people burn with it. Avatas joins me on the wide prow while Dex barks orders at the captain to move faster. Thunder echoes. Navium's drums issuing coded orders with a frenzy one only ever hears during an attack. Harper's silver face is tight, his mouth drawn down in what is almost a frown. He spent hours on the road teaching me to close my mind against intrusion, which meant a great deal of time staring into each other's faces. I've gotten to know his well. Whatever news he's about to deliver, it's bad. Grimmar and his forces attacked at dawn 3 weeks ago, he says. Our spies say the Korkans have been hit by a famine in the south. Tens of thousands dead. They've been raiding the southern coast for months now, but we had outdated information on the fleet they'd amassed. They showed up with more than 300 ships and struck the merchant harbour first. Of the 250 merchant vessels at port, 243... were destroyed. That's a blow the Mercator Gens won't soon forget. Countermeasures? Admiral Leonidas took the fleet out twice. The first time, we took down 3 barbarian craft before a squall forced us back to port. The second time, Grimmar pressed the attack and drove us back. Grimmar drove back Admiral Leonidas? Whoever this sky's forsaken Karkan is, he's no fool. Leonidas has commanded the Empire's navy for the past 30 years. He designed Navium's military port, the island, a watchtower with an enormous body of water surrounding it, and a circular protected port beyond, which houses men, ships, and supplies. He has fought the barbarians for decades from the island. According to the report, Grimar counted every trick Leonidas threw at him. After that, the Karkans choked off the port. The city is effectively under siege, and the death toll is up to 1,000 in the southwest quarter. That's where Grimar is hitting the hardest. The southwest quarter is almost entirely plebeian. Dock workers, sailors, fishermen, coopers, blacksmiths, and their families. Caris Veturia is orchestrating an operation to rout the next barbarian attack. Caris shouldn't be orchestrating anything without Leonidas to temper her, I say. Where is he? After his second failure, she executed him, Avitas says, and from his long pause, I know he's as disturbed at the news as I am. For gross dereliction of duty, 2 days ago. That old man lived and breathed duty. I am numb. Leonidas trained me personally for 6 months when I was a fiver, just before I got my mask. He was one of the few southern paters my father trusted. He fought the Karkans for 50 years, knew more about them than anyone alive. Officially, the Commandant felt that he had lost too many men in the attacks and ignored too many of her warnings. And unofficially, she wanted to take control. Damn her to the hells. Why did the illustrian paters allow it? She's not a deity. They could have stopped her. You know how Leonidas was, Shrike, Avitas says. He didn't take bribes, and he didn't let the paters tell him what to do. He treated illustrians and maceters and plebeians alike. The way they saw it, he let the merchant harbour burn. And now Caris is in command of Navium. She summoned us, Avitas says. We've been informed that an escort will bring us to her. She is at the island. Hag. She is already attempting to wrest control from me before I've even entered the city. I meant to go to the island first, but now if I do, I will appear the supplicant, seeking approval from my betters. Curse her summons. A commotion at the docks catches my attention. The chuffing screams of horses split the air, and I spot the black and red armour of a black guard. The soldier curses as he attempts to keep hold of the beasts, but they buck and jerk away from him. Then, as suddenly as they began to panic, the beasts calm, dropping their heads as if drugged. Every man on the dock steps back. A figure in black comes into view. Bleeding hells, Avitas murmurs from beside me. The Nightbringer's eerie bright eyes fix on me. But I am not surprised. I expected Caris to keep that djinn monster close. She knows I'm trying to kill her. She knows that if she can use her supernatural pet to get into my head, I'll never succeed. I think back to the hours spent with Avitas, learning to shield my mind. Hours listening to his calm voice explain how to imagine my innermost thoughts as gems locked in a chest, hidden in a shipwreck at the bottom of a forgotten sea. Harper doesn't know about Livia's pregnancy. I spoke of it to no one. But he knows the Empire's future depends on destroying the Commandant. He was an exacting instructor. But he could not test my skill. I hope to the skies that my preparation was enough. If Caris learns Livy is pregnant, she'll have assassins descending within days. But as we dock, my thoughts are scattered. Pull yourself together, Shrike. Livy's life depends on it. The Empire depends on it. When I step onto the gangplank, I do not look into the Nightbringer's eyes. I made that mistake once before, months ago, when I met him back in Serra. Now I know that his eyes showed my future. I saw the deaths of my family that day. I didn't understand it at the time. I assumed my own fear had gotten the best of me.
Welcome, Bloodshrike.
I cannot hide my shudder at the way the Nightbringer's voice scrapes against my ear. He beckons me closer. I am Mater of Jens Aquila. I am a mask. I am a black guard. I am the Bloodshrike, right hand to the Emperor of the Marshals. I order my body to remain still while I stare him down with all the power of my rank. My body betrays me. The sounds of the river docks fade. No water slapping against the hulls of ships. No stevedores calling out to each other. No masts creaking, and no distant boom of sails or roar of the sea. The silence that cloaks the djinn is complete, an aura that nothing can penetrate. Everything falls away as I close the distance between us. Maintain control, Shrike. Give him nothing. Ah, the Nightbringer says quietly when I stand before him.
Felicitations, Bloodshrike. I see you are to be an aunt.
Chapter 14. Liar. The Mariner prison is spare, cold, and eerily silent. As I pace my poorly lit cell, I place a hand against the stone wall. It is so thick that I could scream and scream, and Darin, across the hall from me, might never know. He must be going mad. I imagine him clenching and unclenching his fists, boots scraping against the floor, wondering when we will escape, if we will escape. This place might not be Koff, but it is still a prison. And my brother's demons will not let him forget it. Which means I must stay level-headed for the both of us and find a way out of here. The night creeps by, dawn breaks, and it's not until the late afternoon that the lock on my door clanks and three figures backlit by lamplight step into my cell. I recognize one as the captain who arrested us, and a second as one of her soldiers. But it is the third woman, tall and heavily cloaked, who catches my attention. Because she is surrounded by ghouls. They gather like hungry crows at her feet, hissing and pawing at her. I know instantly that she cannot see them.
Bring in the brother, Captain Aliba.
The woman Seren is husky and musical. She could be a Kahani with a voice like that. She looks to be around Afia's age, or perhaps a bit older, with light brown skin and thick, straight black hair pulled up in a knot. Her back is poker straight, and she walks gracefully, as if balancing a book on her head.
Sit, child, she says, and though her voice is pleasant enough, an underlying malice raises my hackles. Are the ghouls influencing her? I did not know they had such power.
They feed off sorrow and sadness and the stink of blood.
Spiro Telamon spoke those words to me long ago. What sorrow plagues this woman? Darin soon joins me, slowing when he enters, eyes wide. He sees the ghouls, too. When he takes a seat on my cot beside me, I reach for his hand and squeeze. They cannot hold us. I will not let them. The woman observes me for a long moment before smiling.
You, she says to me, look nothing like the lioness.
And you, she glances at Darin.
Are her spitting image. Clever of her to keep you hidden. I expect it's why you're still alive.
The ghouls slither up the woman's cloak, hissing into her ear. Her lips curve into a sneer.
But then my father tells me that Mira always enjoyed her little secrets. I wonder why you like her in other ways. Looking always to fight instead of fix. to break, instead of build. To...
You shut it about my mother! My face grows hot. How dare you!
You will please address Crown Princess Nicola of Marin as Princess, or Your Highness, Aliba says, and you will speak with respect for one of her station.
This woman, infested with ghouls who are influencing her mind, will one day rule Marin. I want to frighten the fey creatures away from her, but I cannot manage it without looking as if I'm attacking her. Mariners are less skeptical than scholars when it comes to the fey, but something tells me she still won't believe me if I tell her what I see.
Don't bother, Aliba, Nicola snorts. I should have known she'd have the same lack of subtlety the lioness did. Now, girl, let us discuss why you are here.
Please, I speak through gritted teeth, knowing that my life is in Nicola's hands. My brother and I are here to
make Serik steal weaponry, Nicola says. Supply the scholar refugees flooding the city. Instigate an uprising. Challenge the mariners, despite all we have done for your people since the Empire uprooted them hundreds of years ago.
I am so flabbergasted that I almost cannot speak. No, I sputter. No, Princess, you have it wrong. We're not here to make weaponry. Do I tell her of the Nightbringer? Of Shaver? I think of the stories of fey violence whispered along the road, stories I've been hearing for months. The ghouls may tell her that I lie, but I must warn her. A threat approaches, Princess. A great threat. You have no doubt heard the tales of mariner ships sinking in calm seas, of children disappearing in the dead of night. Beside Nicola, Aliba stiffens, her eyes jerking toward mine, filled with recognition. She knows. But Nicola holds up a hand. The ghouls chuckle nastily, slitted red eyes fixed on me.
You sent your allies ahead of you to spread such lies among the scholar population, she says. Tales of monsters out of legend. Yes, your little friends did your work well.
Araj, the Skirite. I sigh. Elias warned me that the Skirite leader would spread word of my exploits far and wide. I hadn't given it much thought.
They seeded your reputation among the newly arrived scholars, a downtrodden and easily manipulated population. And then you arrived with your brother, your mother's legacy, and promises of Serik Steel, safety, and security. All insurgents tell the same tale, girl. It just changes a bit with the telling.
We don't want trouble. My trepidation rises, but I channel my grandfather, Pop, thinking of the time he delivered twins and I panicked. It was my first delivery, and with a few words, his serenity soothed me until my hands no longer shook.
We just want to... Don't patronize me. My people have done everything for yours.
Nicola paces the small cell, the ghouls following her like a pack of loyal dogs.
We have taken them into our city and integrated them into the fabric of mariner culture. But our generosity is not without limits. Here in Marin, we are not sadists, like the marshals. But we do not take kindly to rabble-rousers. Know that if you do not cooperate with me, I will have Captain Aliba put you both on the next ship down to the tribal lands, as we did your friends.
Oh, hells. So that's what happened to Araj and Tass and the rest of the Skirite. Skies, I hope they are all right. The tribal lands are crawling with marshals. I try to temper my anger, but the more this woman talks, the more I want to scream. If you send us there, we'll be killed.
or enslaved?
Indeed. Nicola tilts her head, and the lamplight makes her eyes as red as the ghoul's.
Did the Nightbringer set the ghouls on her? Is she another of his human allies, like the Warden or the Commandant?
I have an offer for you, Darin of Serra, Nicola goes on. If you've any sense, you'll see that it's more than fair. You wish to make Serric steel? Very well. Make Serric steel for the Mariner army. We will provide you what you need, as well as accommodations for you and your sister.
No. Darren's gaze is fixed to the floor, and he shakes his head. I won't do it.
Won't, I note. Not can't.
A spark of hope flares within. Does my brother remember how to make the steel after all? Did something on the road from the Forest of Dusk to Edessa shake loose, allowing him to recall that which Spiro had taught him?
Consider.
I won't do it, Darren stands, towering over Nicola by half a foot. Aliba steps in front of the princess, but Darren speaks quietly, hands open at his sides. I won't arm another group of people so that my own can live at their mercy.
Please,
let us go, I kick out at the ghouls, scattering them for a moment before they congeal around Nicola again. We don't mean you any harm, and you have greater things to worry about than two scholars who want to stay out of trouble. The Empire has turned on the tribes, and it might turn on Marin, too.
The Marshals have a treaty with Marin.
They had a treaty with the tribes, too, I say, and yet hundreds have been killed or captured in the tribal desert. This new Emperor, you do not know him, Princess. He's different. He's not someone you can work with. He's...
Don't talk politics to me, little girl.
She doesn't see the ghoul that clings to the side of her face, its mouth split in an odious smile. The sight of it nauseates me.
I was a force to be reckoned with in my father's court well before you were born.
She turns to Darren.
My offer stands. Make weapons for my army, or take your chances in the tribal lands. You have until dawn tomorrow to decide.
Darren and I don't bother discussing Nicola's offer. I know there is no chance in the hells that he would accept. The ghouls have their hooks in her, which likely means the Nightbringer has a hand in Mariner politics. The last thing the scholars need is another group lording it over us because we do not have the weapons for a fair fight. You said, won't. I considered long and hard before bringing up Darin's seemingly offhand comment. My brother paces the cell, antsy as a penned horse. When Nicola asked you to make the weapons, you didn't say you can't do it. You said, you won't.
Slip of the tongue.
Darren stops his pacing, his back to me, and though it stings to admit it, he's lying. Do I push him or let it go? You've been letting it go, liar. Letting it go means Izzy died for nothing. It means Elias was imprisoned for nothing. It means Afia's cousin died for nothing. I try a different tack. Do you think, Spiro?
Could we not talk about Spiro, or weaponry, or forging?
Darren sits down beside me, shoulders slumped, as if the walls of the cell are making him smaller. He clenches and unclenches his fists.
How the hells are we going to get out of here?
An excellent question.
A soft voice says from the door. I jump. Seconds ago, it was sealed shut.
One that I might have a solution to. If you care to hear it.
A young, dark-skinned scholar man leans against the doorframe in full view of the guards, except I realize there are no guards to see him. They have disappeared. The man is handsome, with black hair that's half pulled up and the rangy body of a swordsman.
His forearms are tattooed, though in the darkness, I cannot make out the symbols. He tosses a key up and down like a ball. There is an insouciance to him that irritates me. The glint of his eyes and his wily smile are instantly familiar. I know you. I take a step back, wishing I had my dagger with me. You're our shadow. The man drops into a mocking bow, and I am immediately distrustful. Darin bristles.
I am Musa of Adisa, the man says. Son of Ziad and Osmat of Adisa. Grandson of Mehed and Syra of Adisa. I am also the only friend you have in this city.
You said you have a solution to our problem. Trusting this man would be stupid, but Darin and I need to get the hells out of here. All Nicola's talk about putting us on a ship sounded like rubbish. She will not let a man who knows the secret of Serik Steel simply walk away.
I'll get you two out of here. For a price.
Naturally. What price?
You, he looks at Darin, will make weapons for the Scholars. And you, he turns to me, will help me resurrect the Northern Scholars' resistance.
In the long silence that follows his proclamation, I want to laugh. If our circumstances were less dire, I would have. No, thank you. I've had enough of the bleeding resistance. And those who support it.
I expected you to say as much, Musa says. After the way Mazin and Keenan betrayed you.
He offers a grim smile as my fists curl, and I stare at him in shock. How does he know?
Apologies, he says. Not Keenan. The Nightbringer. In any case, your mistrust is understandable. But you need to stop the Djinn Lord, no? Which means you need out of here.
Darin and I gape at him. I get my voice back first. How do you know about the—
I watch. I listen.
Musa taps his foot and glances down the hall. His shoulders stiffen. Voices rise and fall from beyond the door to the cell block, sharp and hurried.
Decide, he says. We're nearly out of time.
No, Darin speaks for us both, and I frown. It's unlike him.
You should leave, unless you want to get thrown in here with us. I'd heard you were stubborn, Musa sighs. Listen to logic, at least. Even if you do find your way out of here, how will you find the beekeeper while the mariners hunt you? Especially if he doesn't want to be found.
How did— I stop myself from asking. He's already told me. He watches. He listens. You know the beekeeper?
I swear I'll take you to him.
Musa cuts his hand, blood dripping on the floor, and I raise my eyebrows. A blood oath is no small thing.
After I get you out of here. If you agree to my terms. But we need to move. Now.
Darin, I grab my brother's arm and drag him to a corner of the cell. If he can take us to the beekeeper, we'll save weeks of time.
I don't trust him, Darin says. You know I want to get out of here as much as you do. More. But I won't make a promise I can't keep, and neither should you.
Why does he want you to help him with the resistance? What's in it for him? Why not do it himself? I don't trust him either, I say. But he's offering us a way out. I consider my brother. I consider his lie earlier. And though I don't want to hurt him, I know that if we ever want to get out of here, I have to.
Pardon me, Musa says. But we really need to—
Shut it! I snap at him before turning back to Darin. You lied to me, I say, about the weapons. No, I raise my hand at his protest. I'm not angry, but I don't think you understand what you're doing. You're choosing not to make the weapons. It's a selfish choice. Our people need you, Darin, and that should matter more than your desires or your pain. You saw what's happening out there to the Scholars, I say. It's not going to stop. Even if I defeat the Nightbringer, we'll always be lesser unless we can stand up for ourselves. We need Serik Steel.
Liar,
I want to make it. I do.
Then try, I say. That's all I'm asking. Try. For Izzy. For Afia, who has lost a half dozen of her tribe trying to help us. For, my voice cracks. For Elias. For the life he gave up for you.
Darren's blue eyes widen in surprise and hurt. His demons rise, demanding his attention. But somewhere beneath the fear, he is still the lioness's son. And this time, the quiet courage he has had all our lives wins out.
Where you go, sis, he says. I go. I'll try.
In seconds, Musa, who has been shamelessly eavesdropping, gestures us into the hall. The moment Darren is out, he grabs Musa by the neck and shoves him against the wall. I hear a sound like an animal chittering, but it goes silent after Musa makes a strange slashing motion with his hand. A ghoul?
If you hurt my sister, Darren says quietly, if you betray her, or abuse her trust, or cause her pain, I swear to the skies, I will kill you.
Musa chokes out an answer, and as Darren lets him down, keys clang in the door down the hall. Seconds later, it flies open, and Aliba enters, Sim drawn.
Musa, she snarls, I should have bleeding known. You are under arrest. Well, now you've done it.
Musa rubs his neck where Darren grabbed him, mild irritation on his fine features.
We could have been away by now, if not for your brotherly posturing.
With that, he whispers something, and Aliba falls back, cursing, as if something we cannot see attacks her. Musa looks between Darren and me with arched brows.
Any other threats? Discussions you wish to waste my time with? None? Good. Then let's get the bleeding hells out of here.
Dawn approaches by the time Musa, Darren, and I emerge from a tailor's shop and out into Adisa. My head spins from the strange, interconnected series of tunnels, passageways, and alleys Musa took to get us here. But we are out. We are free.
Not bad timing, Musa says. If we hurry, we can get to a safe house before—
Wait! I grab him by the shoulder. We're not going anywhere with you. Beside me, Darren nods vehemently. Not until you tell us who you are. Why did Captain Aliba know you? What in the skies attacked her? I heard a noise. It sounded like a ghoul. Since Princess Nikla was crawling with them, you understand why I am concerned. Musa easily extricates himself from my grip, straightening his shirt, which I notice is quite finely made for a scholar.
She wasn't always like that, he says. Nick, the princess, I mean. But that doesn't matter now. Dawn is only a few hours away. We really don't have time.
Stop making excuses, I snarl, and start explaining. Musa groans in irritation.
If I answer one question, he says, will you stop being so annoying? And let me get you to a safe house.
I consider, glancing at Darren, who gives me a non-committal shrug. Now that Musa's gotten us out, I only need one bit of information from him. Once I get it, I can become invisible and knock him out, and Darren and I can disappear. Fine, I say. Who's the beekeeper, and how can I find him?
Liar of Sarah.
His white teeth shine like those of a smug horse. He offers me his arm, and under the brightening sky, I finally get a closer look at his tattoos. Dozens of them, big and small, all clustered around a hive. Bees.
It's me, of course, Musa says. Don't tell me you hadn't guessed.
Chapter 15. Elias. For days, I cajole and threaten and lure the ghosts away from the border wall. Skies only know what will happen if they break out. They grow more frenzied by the hour, it seems, until I can barely hear myself think over their accursed caterwauling. A fortnight after I've left Arboret, and with no sense of how to move the ghosts any quicker or how to help the Fakira, I retire to Shaver's cottage for the night, desperately grateful for this, my only sanctuary. The ghosts pour at me as I enter, wild as an Isle South typhoon.
She shouldn't have.
My husband, is he here? Tell me. Have you seen my lovey?
Usually I feel guilty when I close the cottage door on the ghosts. Not today. I'm too exhausted, too angered by my failure, too disgusted by the relief I feel at the sudden, complete silence within Shaver's home.
Sleep in the cottage. They cannot hurt you here.
Somehow, Shaver magicked the cottage to insulate it from the ghosts and djinn. That bit of sorcery didn't die with her. She knew I would need a place where I could collect my thoughts, and I am grateful for it. But my thankfulness doesn't last long. After I've cleaned up and cooked a paltry meal that Shaver would have scoffed at, I can't bring myself to sleep. I pace in a circle, guilt gnawing at my gut. The soulcatcher's boots still sit by her bed. The arrows she was fletching lie untouched on her work table. These small tokens from her life used to bring me comfort, especially in the days just after she died. Like the cottage itself, they reminded me that she believed I could be soulcatcher. But tonight, her memory plagues me.
Why did you not listen to me, Elias? Why did you not learn?
Skies, she would be so disappointed. I kick at the door violently. A stupid decision, as now my foot aches. I wonder if my entire life will be a series of moments in which I realize I'm an idiot, long after I can actually do anything about it. Will I ever feel like I know what I'm doing? Or will I be an old man, tottering about, flummoxed by whatever recent foolishness I've committed?
Don't be pathetic.
Strangely,
Caris Vittoria's taut voice rises in my mind.
You know the question. How do you move the ghosts faster? Now find the answer. Think.
I consider Arboret's words.
You must move the spirits, and to do that you must remove yourself from the world.
A variation on Shaver's advice. But I have removed myself from the world. I said farewell to Lyra and Darin. I kept away all others who approached the forest. I burgle my supplies quietly from villages instead of buying them from another human the way I yearn to.
The forest will show thee its sly memory.
Were the mysteries referring to Martha, or was there something more to the statement?
Forest could be referring to something else entirely,
Arboret had said. The ghosts, perhaps? But they don't spend enough time in the waiting place to know anything. Though, now that I think of it, not all of the spirits move on swiftly. The wisp. I grab my sims, more out of habit than because I actually need them, and head out. Just before entering the cottage, I heard her voice. But she's not here now.
Damn you, Elias, think.
The wisp used to avoid Shaver. When the ghost speaks at all, it's to me, and it's always about her lovey. And unlike the other shades, she likes water. She often lurks near a spring just south of the cottage. The path to it is well worn. When I moved into the cottage, Shaver lost no time in passing all water-fetching chores to me.
What's the point of having muscles? She teased. If you can't carry things for others.
I catch a glint of white as I draw closer, and soon find the wisp at the edge of the spring, staring down into it. She turns her face toward me and flits backward. She's in no mood to talk, but I can't afford to let her get away.
You're looking for your lovey, right?
The wisp stops and appears before me so suddenly that I rock back on my heels.
You know where she is?
Her thin voice is painfully happy, and guilt twists in my gut.
Not exactly, I say. But perhaps you could help me, and I could help you.
The wisp tilts her head, considering. I'm trying to learn about the magic of the waiting place, I say before she disappears again. About Ma'atha. You've been here a long time. Can you tell me anything about the forest having a memory?
Where is my lovey?
I curse. I should have known better than to think a ghost, and one who refuses to move on, could help me. I'm sorry, I say. I'll look for your lovey. I turn back for the cottage. Perhaps I need sleep. Perhaps I'll have a better idea in the morning. Or I could go back to Arborit and see if she remembers anything else, or find another Fakira.
The memory is in the pain.
I spin so fast, it's a miracle my head doesn't fly off. What? What did you say?
The memory is in the pain.
The wisp circles me, and I spin as she does. I'm not letting her out of my sight.
The memory is where the greatest hurt lies, the greatest anger.
What in ten hells do you mean, the greatest hurt?
A hurt like mine. The memory is in the pain, little one, in their pain. They burn with it, for they have lived with it much longer than I.
Their pain. The djinn. My stomach sinks. You're speaking of the djinn. But the wisp is gone now, calling out to her lovey. I try to follow her, but I can't keep up. Other ghosts, drawn by my voice, cluster near, flooding me with their suffering. I windwalk away from them, though I know it's wrong to ignore their misery. Eventually, they'll find me again, and I'll be forced to try to pass some on, simply so I don't lose my mind at their badgering. But before they do, I need to sort this out. The longer I wait, the more the ghosts will amass. Think quickly, Elias. Could the djinn help me? They've been imprisoned here for 1,000 years, but they were free once, and they possess the most powerful magic in the land. They are fae, born of magic, like the Ifrits, the Wraiths, the Ghouls. Now that the idea is in my head, I've latched onto it like a dog to a bone. The djinn must have some deeper knowledge of the magic, and I need to figure out a way to get it from them.